Welcome to the Joe Cohen Show. Join me as I share my experience with biohacking and invite top health experts to explore the latest technology, supplements, research, and resources for optimizing your body and brain. Hey everyone, I'm excited to be here with Dr. Rita Marie. She's the founder of the Institute of Nutritional Endocrinology. She's passionately committed to transforming our broken, disease-focused system into a true healthcare system where every practitioner is skilled at finding the root cause of health challenges and uses the wisdom of nature combined with modern scientific research to restore balance. Dr. Rita Marie is a licensed doctor of chiropractic with certifications in acupuncture, nutrition, herbal medicine, and heart math, who specializes in insulin, thyroid, adrenal, and digestive imbalances. She also focuses a lot on genetics and precision health. And so I'd like to get her take on how she uses precision health in her practice and what we can learn from precision health. So thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, I believe that there's no one size fits all for anything, for any health complaint, for people. There's no magic bullet. As much as I wish there was, and as much as most people wish there was, right? We want to hit the easy button and just get here. This is what you need to do. And in reality, it takes work, right? We know as health practitioners, it takes work to restore balance. So given that, what I like to do when I'm looking at somebody, usually the people that we see are people who have been around the block a few times, who've had a lot of health challenges, been to lots of practitioners, including some functional medicine and alternative type practitioners. And they're getting a one size fits all. Just get this acupuncture treatment, take these herbs. And they're not really getting to what's going on. The other issue is that getting people to take action is often hard, right? No matter how many times around the block they've been and how many bad starts they've had, when it comes down to, hey, you're going to have to change your diet, change your attitude, change your sleep patterns, do things actually to get your health back, there's oftentimes that hold back. What I find is I love to incorporate the genetics as part of that big assessment piece, because when I do, people, not from a standpoint of, oh, no wonder I'm so sick, no wonder my neurotransmitters, no wonder, wonder. It's more from the standpoint of, oh, I have this maybe leaning in this direction, and I have to take you more seriously than I would if I didn't. I have to take you seriously when you tell me I need to go gluten-free, or I have to take you seriously when you say I really need to do these things to protect my heart, to protect my lungs, to protect whatever. And I find it's one of the most motivating things that I can do with people is to say, hey, you have genetic factors. You have some of these cardiac risk genes that have been shown to be cardiac risk, whether they're 100% accurate or not, they are shown to be at putting you at potential risk. So therefore, you've got to protect your heart in all these other ways. So I love using the genetic in my practice for that reason.
Yeah. And all these genes are accurate in the sense that they do contribute to risk. And you could look at the mechanisms there, which is very interesting. It's very complex. That's why I think it's very difficult. But that's where I think you want to combine the polygenic risk scores to get like an overall picture. And then you get that functional health picture from the mechanisms, right? Like finding these, okay, you have this biochemical pathway. It seems like we could do some more improvement there.
Yep.
Would you agree with that approach?
Oh, totally. Yeah, totally. And one of the things people don't even realize is that their regular blood tests that they get every year from their doctor, and the doctor looks and goes, oh, you're fine so far. No diabetes yet. No heart disease yet. And then they come back a year later, huh, last year you were fine. What they're not looking at is patterns, and they're heading in the wrong direction. They're not combining that with their lifestyle factors, with their genetic risks, et cetera. And people are walking along their merry way thinking, fine, I'm fine. I'm just going to keep smoking my cigarettes and drinking my Coke and whatever, until they find themselves flat on their back. And I want to help people before they're flat on their back. Unfortunately, a lot of the people that I do see have been through that mill in many decades, and they are flat on their back or close to it, and we're having to raise them from the dead, which is a lot more difficult than preventing them from keeling over in the first place.
Yeah, definitely. I think when it comes to disease, many people don't realize that they build over time. Even cancer, right? It starts many years before there's a big tumor, right? Cardiovascular disease, like any serious disease or pretty much anything, it starts much smaller and then it snowballs. It builds up damage over time. And the problem is that if you catch it too late, people, it's a lot harder to treat once the damage is done. I completely share that perspective. Are most of your clients, are they the type that were drinking, smoking before, or they were trying to be healthy, but they just don't know the right things for their genetics?
Both. I would say by the time they come to me, they've already been to every summit and every podcast out there, and they're trying to do all the DIY stuff and learning. And they've either tried or already quit smoking and the really obvious bad stuff. But a lot of them are doing what they think is good stuff, but it's not necessarily good stuff for them, right? They don't know that they have to be much more careful than the average person, say, with glycemic food index, right? And their blood sugar is mounting, and doctor's not going to tell them there's a problem until they have diabetes. We're going to help them to see that they're heading that way. And look at, and a lot of them already have the symptoms of diabetes before they get it, right? The retinopathies and nephropathies and neuropathies and stiffened cardiovascular, the endothelium and all that. But nobody's really putting all the risk factors together. So I like to just put it into one whole big, here's what's happening to you functionally. Here's where your genetic risks lie. Here's what you're doing in your life that's creating this snowball that's very soon going to be heading downhill much faster than you can stop it.
Are you looking at the polygenic risk scores to see what's going to happen? And then you use the functional SNPs to try to prevent that? Is that the approach? Or
my approach is somebody comes in, I take a very extensive history. I don't just say, hey, where does it hurt? How long has it been hurting? Okay, here's your supplement to take. No, it's a very extensive history looking at the whole progression of what they're complaining, what their current complaints are, but also what's their life been? What's their stressors been? What are their exposures been? What has their diet been? And it's really looking at that and putting that in and of itself creates to me a risk score. And then we'll look at most of them come in with some basic labs. We look at their basic labs and pinpoint all the different patterns that are there that the conventional medicine isn't trained to look for. And we pull that together with the genetics. Not everybody wants to do the genetics, but most people do. Some people are like, oh, I don't want to do that. I don't want to know that I am going to get Parkinson's. And I say, well, it doesn't mean you're going to get it. What it means is if you have a risk factor there, that there's things that we can do and we can intervene much more aggressively to help prevent you from going down that pathway. Not everybody wants to go that way. Or I've had some people say, run my genetics, look at it, incorporate what into my program, but don't tell me about the genetics. So
that's very interesting.
I've had that happen. And I'm like, okay, so then I'm building things in to protect them from going down a path that they could otherwise go down if they're not careful and if they don't take care of the environment and the diet and all that. Because most people don't realize from the time we're born, every morsel we put in our body is a message to ourselves to be good
absolutely.
Or not good.
Yeah, absolutely. I think really that there's a few promises for genetics in my point of view. And I'm curious if you see it the same way. But basically, there's the prevention aspect. Mm-hmm. With prevention, you don't know exactly what you're like. What are you going to die from first, right? Or what are you going to get first? Most people don't get Alzheimer's, right? But if you're one of those people that do, then that's the thing that's going to kill you first. Mm-hmm. Same with cancer or heart disease. So I feel like most people want to know what are they going to get first. And that's, by the way, we're launching a new product as well, just so you know. It's called the Longevity Screener. We look at all the major diseases. We could tell you, here's what you're going to get first. Here's like the main thing. Right now we have it based on, we give you higher risk, lower risk, birth percentile, but we could tell you on an absolute risk basis what is
more likely.
You're 30 times more likely to get this, which is going to be very significant. And so that's going to be like, yeah. So I feel like that hits a certain market where what you're doing is you want to know, what is this person going to get in 30 years from now? Because if somebody already comes to you with Alzheimer's, I don't know. Do you think you can do, how much do you think you could do there? I'm actually curious.
Yeah, reversing it. Dale Bredesen has a whole lot of stuff in his work, and there's several people who have done it, but I think it's more arresting it. And I think, again, it's looking at, because it's looking at risk factors. He talks about 36 holes in the roof. And if you have a drug that addresses one, good luck. You're not going to do much to reverse this disease. But I think there are things that can be done to stabilize it and improve it and prevent it from getting worse. Related to toxicity, I guess
it also depends on what it's from. So there's probably different kinds. If you have just cognitive decline, they're like, okay, you've got dementia, whatever. If it reaches above a certain threshold, but there's probably the kind where like you've done serious damage to your brain,
right? Yeah,
and then there's the kind where your brain's not working very well because you're in some toxic situation.
Yeah, or stress situation, right? Sympathetic overdrive and all that. And I think that's true. I think that what happens is, I think public awareness that you're heading there, right? Because a lot of people don't notice until somebody in their life says, okay, you're really gone. You don't remember anything. They can't finish your sentences. You're wandering through the neighborhood lost, right? But there's early signs. And those of us who have read up on it, I'm like, oh, I just forgot where I put my keys. Is that okay? Let me watch that. Oh, I just forgot the name of my best friend in high school. And that's probably not the same thing because it's usually short-term memory. So I know things and I can be aware and I can see it in people. But I'll give you an example. Actually, I just thought about this. A few years back, probably 10, 12 years ago, my husband started to exhibit those kinds of symptoms, like I said that to you yesterday. You don't remember it now. And a lot of that stuff. And so we had a good talk about some of the things he could do to support his cognitive system. And he did. He started taking some supplements and he changed some dietary things and he got his blood sugar under control. And now he's not having that problem at all. But I was aware enough to be able to see something before he went too far down that. On the other hand, I have a good friend, dear friend, and she's way far gone. She's just, two of them, and they're both right around my age, and they're different people because they're too gone. And no matter what, I don't think you can reverse it, but I still think you can arrest the decline because if you keep beating them over the head with the toxins and the high blood sugar and all that, then they're just going to keep getting worse, and maybe you can at least arrest it so it doesn't get so far gone.
Absolutely. So yeah, I guess it depends on the stage exactly. And sometimes it might look like a very advanced stage, but that's just because somebody's really not living healthy at all. Right. And then they reverse certain things and they're like, wow, I could think a lot better. And it was just like some damage, but then 75% was just reversible.
And that's always the key the tricky part about working with people is how far gone are they, right? Somebody has Hashimoto's and their thyroid, if they've had that for a very long time and their thyroid has been beaten, there may not be the mechanisms there anymore. But when you catch it early, which we test everybody for thyroid antibodies, even before they have other signs, even before they have symptoms, it's just a routine part of what we do. And if they have antibodies, we're like, you're heading in that direction. Let's reverse this. And we can, right? Because the thyroid's still intact.
Okay. So the genetics, what we have is predicting, seeing what is somebody at high risk for in the future, and then also using it to prioritize certain treatments over some other treatments, let's say. And then also maybe the motivational piece is big.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then lab tests. Let's talk about lab tests a little bit. What kind of lab tests are you getting for all your patients?
So everybody gets a functional blood chemistry. So they come in with whatever they got from their doctor. We look at, we analyze it through some software or just my brain. Because I've been doing this long enough, I don't need the software to do that. But And we say, okay, we also need this and this based on your history. We need all these inflammatory markers. Oh, we want an advanced lipid panel based on this and that and the other thing. And I get people started and I listen to what they're eating, what they're doing, how they're sleeping. And I'm not going to jump in right away and put people on $500 worth of supplements every month if it's real obvious that their cigarette smoking and their 12 cup of coffee a day and their donuts and all that are major contributing factors. So I like to get people to, I like to empower people to take action. And people, they get it when you have to, they have to take a whole bunch of supplements, but they get it that it hopefully not a long-term thing. It's a supplement to a good diet. And we really look at all the basics, all the lifestyle factors, the diet, the exercise, the stress levels, the sleep, the exposures, all of that stuff needs to be taken into account. And that's where I think that they've been shuttled through the system when they've been through Western medicine is because 15 minutes, it doesn't fit. If it has a diagnosis, here you go. Here's your drug for it. If it doesn't have a diagnosis, then shuttle you off to another specialist or a psychiatrist or whatever, because it doesn't fit their molds of put them in the box and they're this. And we're looking at what are all the functional imbalances. So we do the functional blood chemistry. A lot of people will.
What does functional blood chemistry mean?
Blood chemistry is what everybody gets, the glucose right. And this and that. Functional blood chemistry I look at is having some additional markers that give
like
us
what,
more
for
function.
Example?
So for example, the typical looks at glucose. Okay. Unless you're diabetic, you don't get an A1C, you don't get insulin. We run insulin on everybody because I think that's one of the early markers of metabolic decline that is missed until somebody's off the charts. And then you go, oh, look at that. And your fasting insulin is 32. Oh, maybe that's why you haven't been able to lose a pound, even though you're starving yourself, whatever. So I look at insulin on everybody. I look at CRP on everybody. I look at homocysteine.
What's your insulin, for example?
Like mine?
What's
I don't
your
know.
Number? Yeah.
I think it was 3.7. Yeah.
Homocysteine?
Homocysteine. I think it went up the last time I did it, but it was right after I broke my arm and had lots of exposures. Oh. So I'm pulling it down. I think it was like 11 or something last time I did it.
Okay.
Normally it's
that's
in the 8
bad.
Range. No, it's not okay. off the charts, but yeah.
So what do you like to see that at?
I like to see it somewhere in that 6 to 8, depending female or male. It's too
six
low.
To eight. Wow.
We're looking at methylation, okay. under methylation kind of things, but or that's over methylation actually. But yeah, somewhere in that 7-8 is a really good range, and a little bit lower on females is even better.
We have in our software less than 9. That's what we put at the optimal. What do you, everybody, there's no real exact number, but
yes,
whatever. But I'm just curious what different people's numbers are.
And I have double FCHFR, right? So that is going to naturally increase.
How much do you exercise a day?
How much? As much as I can do.
Seriously?
Okay. Oh, yeah, seriously. As much days when I exercise.
I find exercise jacks up my homocysteine.
I've always exercised. So I do usually 20, 30 minutes of weightlifting and anywhere from 30 to an hour and a half on aerobics, like running or something like that.
Got it. Okay.
That's usual.
That's a good exercise regimen.
Mm-hmm.
When I say exercise jacks it up, I'm talking about like doing 2 hours a day.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't do that. But when I did, I've done marathons and triathlons and that kind of stuff. And at that point, and I know that they're inflammatory. And given my have a tendency with my genes, I know that I have a tendency to have my homocysteine. But this was last year was the first time it was elevated. So I'm like, okay, what else was going? It was lack of exercise for 3 months because I broke my arm and I was in a cast and I couldn't do it. Although I tried, got those 1 pound weights and did, whatever.
What did you break your arm from?
I was walking on a pool deck, came out of the elevator. Oh. They had a slot, like this slick tile, a puddle, and went down and crashed my elbow against the ground. Yeah, it was nasty. It was nasty.
Okay.
And that was on top of having a year where I did 4 online multi-day live events. Wow. 5 or 6 months, like it was like constant. And then it was like, I crashed. So I have a feeling it was related to that. I'm going to be going back and retesting next month and see where it's at.
And what are you looking for in HSCRP or the inflammatory marker?
I love to see HSCRP 0.3 or below, but definitely one or below. The healthiest people I see are 0.3 or below. So I like to see that. A1C, 4.8 to 5.2. That's my sweet spot range. And that's what I'm looking for. And then insulin.
What do you think? If it's below 4.8, what are you thinking?
If it's below 4.8, I'm thinking maybe hyperinsulinemia.
Oh, okay.
Okay, which would lead to hyperglycemia. So then we start to look at it in a little bit more detail. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. I got you.
But above 5.8, then the obvious, the hyperglycemia and out of control. So we're looking at the insulin as well.
And how many supplements do you take a day?
I'm bad. I have my list of them. And on some days I might take 7 or 8. And most days I don't take any.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. I don't like taking supplements. So, and I just was traveling. I was gone for 3 months and had to unpack everything. So the excuse is it's not all unpacked. And, but the truth is
I'm
bad.
Really good markers and you don't need them.
But I do, you know, I've been taking some stuff to address the homocysteine being high, like B6 and B12 and folate I don't take because I eat plenty of folate, that sort of thing. But yeah, and B2 is another one that's important for the homocysteine that people ignore, magnesium. And unfortunately, I do tend towards magnesium deficiency, but I think I'm better right now the last few weeks because I haven't had a single leg cramp. Unfortunately, I shouldn't wait till I get the leg cramp. I should just be taking it. But anyway, yeah.
So what do you do when someone comes to you and they say, I'm taking 130 supplements?
I'm concerned if they're still not feeling well and they're taking 130 supplements.
No, let's say they're feeling well.
And they're feeling great?
Yeah.
Whatever works for you, right? Are you taking the right supplements? Are you over supplementing? Let's look at levels. But also, sometimes people are taking stuff like herbs that they read about. I just got some resveratrol. I actually took resveratrol the other day as, what's that thing? Japanese knotwood, right? Concentrated Japanese knotwood is. So you read about certain herbs, and that's what I like to do. I like to take food supplements, right? Specific herbs that are rich in certain nutrients. And you read about, oh, this has been found to help longevity. And people say, let me just add that to the regime. Let me add that. That's not my typical person. The typical people I see are super sensitive. So they're they go low and slow, tiny amounts when they add supplements. But yeah, 130 supplements, I'd be like, there's no way I would take 130 supplements a day unless I was.
That's what I take every day.
130 different ones or 130? Yeah. Oh my God.
130 different ones.
How do you do that? You taking supplements all day?
Whether I take it in caps or not is not like I've been, as time goes on, I get better at, okay, this doesn't taste so bad. So then I buy it in a
powder.
Yeah. So I take 3 different shakes in a day and then 3
sit a lot in there.
Stacks of pills. So it's like morning, afternoon, night, and also the 3 different shakes. So there's a lot of room in each shake to put the supplements
put some stuff in.
In each stack in morning, afternoon, and night.
And it works for you. So it works for you, right? If you came in to see me and said, my tummy is bloated all the time and I'm gassy and blah, blah, blah. And like, okay, let's look at these. Oh, my liver is enlarged or these numbers are off. Then you can over supplement, right? You can take too much of something and then the liver's help.
What do you find? So how would you know, let's say, how would you know if I'm over supplementing? What would be the markers you're looking at?
I would look at your liver markers for sure. I would look at your gut markers. I would look at anything that relates to how well you're digesting. On the standard blood chem, it would be like the bun and the creatinine and the proteins and albumin and all that kind of stuff. But the body is this mechanism. It's going to try to keep all that going. I would look at your GGT.
What happens if you take two? What do you think the problems? If I want to know, okay, let's say, is 130 working for me? What are the problems of taking 130?
It depends on what they are and how well they interact with each other. Some of them might counteract each other. So if you're taking certain minerals together, like magnesium and zinc will counteract each other. So then you need more of both in order to get what you need. When you take more than you need of certain nutrients, your body down regulates the digestive absorption. So if you're taking this much, you might be absorbing 90%. If you're taking this much, you're absorbing 10%. So it becomes diminishing returns almost. If you take too much of your fat solubles, for example, and they store in the liver, they can create inflammation in the liver. If you take too many B vitamins,
how would you measure inflammation in the liver through
AST, ALT, GGT, LDH. Yeah, all of
those are all great.
Yeah.
They're all great. So no inflammation
and
in
no
the liver.
No pain in your liver and no problems digesting fat. So these are all the kind of things I would ask people.
How do you know I don't have any gas or anything like that.
People say, I can't eat nut butters because I get all bloaty and gassy. I can't eat this or that because I just don't digest fat. I'm not a big oil fan because most of the people I see are overweight and oil is just empty calories in my opinion. Unless it's therapeutic, like you're giving them MCT oil to help with their Alzheimer's or you're giving them some specific kind of thing. I use oils in people who are underweight and just can't eat enough to get things on. And that gives them the extra calories so they don't waste away. But in general, I think of oils like white flour. You take most of
the
nutrients
out. Even extra virgin olive oil?
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay.
Because I'll eat olives. I'll eat olives all. Right. But there's a limit to how many olives I can eat. And then you move on.
I can eat a whole bottle of olive.
I have these really great ojito olives that they're my favorite olives, and I can eat a whole bag of them.
Yeah. Okay. But, interesting. No, some people are very big fans of extra virgin olive oil.
Oh, I know. I'm just not a fan of oil because I just don't think it's
the extra calories.
It's extra calories. I certainly don't want extra calories.
I guess it depends on your weight, right? I agree with you. If someone's overweight, if your clients are overweight, then yeah, that makes sense. For me, if I take in a lot of oils, I'll start to gain like a little bit of weight, especially if I'm not exercising that much.
Yeah. But if you're an exercise, like if you're training for a marathon, you're training for triathlons, it's just so much food you can eat. You need calories to sustain that, right? And then that's where you get it from. And that's not
I exercise lately a lot. I would say on average, maybe 2 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
So I do have, I'm pretty lean. So I don't think about calories.
Bodyweight exercises are great. And I like things that you can do quickly, like between appointments. You can do squats. You can do push-ups. I got my pull-up bar. I'm working on ever since the arm break, I can't do pull-up. I'm working on getting a pull-up in. So.
How many were you able to do before the...
Before this accident, I had gotten out of it. I had broken my other arm in an accident.
Oh, man.
10 years before on a boating accident.
Whoa.
I'll tell you, when I had the arm x-rayed for the fracture, and then I had it in a cast, and I went back in at 4 weeks maybe, to see if I was ready to take it off. And the radiologist said, you've developed disuse osteopenia. This one was good. This one is not so good. So my bone density in the arm had gone down from immobilization in 4 weeks, right? So who are couch potatoes and aren't moving, right? You need to move. That's a big contributing factor in osteoporosis. So.
Yeah, it's hard to know what your bone density is without a DEXA scan.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the measures that I look at, try to measure it once a year even. 67% of listeners aren't following the show, so please don't forget to show your support by hitting the follow button now. You'll not only be supporting the show, but also investing in yourself and your health journey, all while helping to keep us ad-free. So what else are you looking for in terms of testing? I'm curious, what else would you look at? What are you looking at in terms of BUN for an optimal range?
Somewhere between, I would say, I don't know, 12, 13, and 18, 20, right? If it starts to get too high, I'm starting to worry about kidney function. If it gets too low, I'm worried about protein intake and digestive capacity. If there's a problem, if they're consistently, their BUN's creeping up and their EGFR is creeping down, then I'll send them out to specialists.
It's a good test. It's actually better than BUN and creatinine because BUN and creatinine are very variable. Meaning like you could have amazing kidney function and high BUN just because you're eating a lot of protein, right? It's
possible, yeah.
I also think that insulin levels affect urea. There's like a lot of things that affect urea. Mm-hmm. And so for me, My urea is actually, my bun is, it tends to be higher with or without supplements. Doesn't make a difference. Just because I eat a lot of protein and also have a lot of muscle mass. Mm-hmm. So I actually just think I discovered a way to bring it down, but I need to test the theory. We'll see if I'm right.
What's the theory?
Yeah. The theory is, so I recently found out I was deficient in chromium.
Okay. How did you find that out? And
first of all, Self-Deco told me to take chromium. And no, I'm not kidding. So what I did was I was like, we recently made some updates to the algorithm. And I was like, okay, now it's really good. So I'm like, I'm going to follow. I take 130 supplements. I'm like, some things I'm taking, I probably don't need to take. And some things I'm not taking, I probably should.
Yeah.
So like, let me just follow the top 35 recommendations. So I went through supplement recommendations one by one. And I got very good results through all. There was seven that I wasn't taking. I had them all and I liked them all. But chromium was one of them and is actually a game changer. The way that Self-Decode, I could show you what Self-Decode looked at when it figured that out. But, and you could see exactly why it was recommending that, which is very interesting.
Do you have a history of blood sugar problems? High insulin, low, or high homocysteine? I can't even say that word right now. I think I need some drink here.
Hydration.
Hemoglobin A1C.
Oh, hemoglobin HbA1c. Yeah. Yeah. So the thing is that my hemoglobin A1c is usually 5.3, given my whole history, it's actually good. Meaning like I'm not someone who's ever had low blood sugar. I've been testing it for a while. It's gone down, like the lowest ever was 5.1, and that was with berberine, but berberine gave me muscle pain.
Mm.
And so because it functions like metformin, which is a mitochondrial toxin to the muscles, which you probably know already. But in any case, it gave me some muscle pain, but it did a good job at lowering my hemoglobin A1C. It's just that, yeah, so I would say that was my lowest. And then recently it's been like 5.3. And but my fasting glucose was higher. It was in the higher 90s.
Ooh.
Typically, it was around low 90s. So it's also fasting. But I used a continuous glucose monitor to check it, and it was fine. So it just, in the morning, for some reason, I have higher fasting glucose. But throughout the day, it was stably at 90.
And you don't have peaks of way up high.
No, and the peaks were fine. Basically, it was very good the whole time. So based on the continuous glucose monitor, based on my HbA1c, it was just something that I felt like I didn't need to worry about, but it did creep up a little. It went to 5.4 my HbA1c, and I'll show you what.
Did you check your insulin?
Yeah, so my insulin is always low.
Excessively low?
Oh, it always has
been
low.
No, like what, how low?
I'll show you.
Okay.
So this is exactly.
Antibody activity that they're not even aware of. And their insulin is super low. So we do a challenge. We do a postprandial insulin to see if there was.
I don't have any antibodies or anything like that. It's not like zero, right? This is my whole history from 2012.
Tiny, I can't see it.
Okay.
There you go. Okay.
But you can't see the.
Yeah, there we go.
Here, I'll put it here. 2012, you could see it was 1.8, 1. Then it went to 9. I don't know what happened there, but
that's interesting.
1, 4.5, 2.6, 3.5, 2.3.
Yeah. Those aren't numbers I would be concerned about.
Nothing concerning. So the insulin was low.
What was this? 2.7? IGF-1. Okay, got it. Did the chromium make a difference when you started taking the chromium?
So I started taking it like literally last week. But what I'm saying, here's why chromium came up. Okay. So number one is I have a genetic predisposition for higher ApoB, and it brings down cholesterol. Acne, low. I have these genetic predispositions. I don't have acne now. I used to.
Mm.
And then mood is always something I'm trying to improve, but I don't have any mood issues now. It's just something I always like to improve. And so it was a goal of mine. I put it as like a goal, cognitive function, mood.
Okay, so it showed up.
And then you see the lab markers. Triglycerides you can see my HbA1c is suboptimal. It went in the suboptimal range. And I did check chromium. The reason I didn't take chromium, I'll show you what happened here. So I was checking chromium. And it used to be higher here. You see, it was like 4.58. Mm-hmm. It was going down over the years. And especially more recently, it went down. You could see here. Mm-hmm. But then it shot up for whatever reason.
But I don't know serum is necessarily the best way to test chromium. So it might have been you had some chromium in your system for whatever reason it went up. So
maybe I just took a food that was very high in chromium, right, or something of that nature. But essentially, like, I do see, I don't know, chromium, I think, is a reasonable test. Serum chromium, I think, is
all right.
I think it's maybe it's not the only way to test it, but it is, mm-hmm, one of the best ways, in my opinion. I might be wrong. But in any case, there's going to be other ways as well. So I'm not saying it's not other ways.
Right.
But you could see that it's lower. But I guess I didn't start taking it just based on this because it also went higher. So I didn't know what was going on. Mm-hmm. I guess I just like, okay, whatever. But it did pick up that it was lower twice here.
Yep.
And also it's going lower. And so it showed me it's being recommended because of this, because my hemoglobin A1C, my fasting glucose. And then these are markers that I got in the optimal range over time, right? But it's saying that, but at one point it was suboptimal. And so it's saying it's still going to help with these.
How high is some your triglycerides? Your triglycerides show abnormal.
Yeah. So it was just, that one happens to be just the last time, again, because I wasn't exercising. Yeah. Normally it's actually, it was the only time it ever came up higher in my, twice in my life.
Time. Yeah. Yeah.
It was at 31, 41, 48. If 5 days before it was 41, then it went to 92. It happened to have been a fluke.
It's not like you have a typical high triglyceride, low HDL.
No.
Yeah.
But it's taking this stuff into account. And I looked at it. I said, okay, I could see why it's recommending it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, my fasting glucose was going up higher. I wasn't that concerned, but still. You could see 199 at 101. Mm-hmm. This one is 92, 101. I was just like, okay, some of it had to do with niacin. And so that's why I lowered my niacin dosage.
How much niacin were you taking?
At the peak, I was taking like 1,500 milligrams a day.
Did that affect your homocysteine? Because a lot of people get their homocysteines go shooting
a little bit. Yeah, it did. It did. Yeah. But I was also taking a lot of methylation supplements. So I did calm it down. I'm taking like 200 milligrams of niacin a day, 300 maybe, depends on the day. But that shouldn't affect my fasting glucose very much. But it was just, okay, what I didn't know is I didn't realize it improved cognitive function and mood.
Mm-hmm.
And I was feeling like, so I did make a certain change in the past few months where I stopped drinking nutritional yeast. And nutritional yeast has a lot of chromium in there. It's a very chromium rich food.
Chromium and B vitamins, tons of B vitamins.
Yeah, absolutely. But I was already taking a lot of B vitamins. I was taking a lot of things that, all the nutrients in nutritional yeast I was already taking.
Mm.
But what I realized was, I realized my mood, and I thought it had to do with some mega dosing experiments I did with AKG and proline. But that's a different story. But I got off of it. I got off. And it did have to do with that, by the way. But then I got off of it for 2 weeks. And I was like, there's something that changed about my mood. I didn't know why. It was a weird mood situation. I don't know. It was just like, it wasn't anxiety. It was like a certain kind of social anxiety. I don't know. Hmm. It was weird. Yeah.
Be sick. And I think of, when I think of social anxiety, I go right to
No, I was taking B6
and zinc.
I was taking B6 and zinc. And I was taking a lot of supplements that were helping. So it wasn't like too bad or anything, but I just felt, okay, I didn't know what was going on. I thought it was going to be temporary. So let me just see what happens, whatever. In hindsight, and so then I just took chromium partly because I put as one of my goals, cognitive function, mood, things like that. And it came up. I'm like, okay, it's mood, cognitive function, glucose, cholesterol, lipids.
Right.
I was like, let me try. It was just, it had one of the biggest effects on my mood.
Really?
Just like, yeah, it was.
Very cool.
And then I was like, that makes sense because I was taking nutritional yeast for a really long time. Mm. And then I just stopped.
Cool. There's so much. This is what's so exciting about the world of nutritional biochemistry. Is that there's no one size fits all, like I said at the beginning. there's so many little nuances to it. And it's when we are, as practitioners, really curious. I think curiosity is one of the most important things we need to have in discovery and looking to see, okay, what can we do? What kind of little tweaks can we make here? Where are things out of balance? How do we get them back in balance? And then, of course, taking in mind the genetics, I think makes a big difference, because then you go, oh, no wonder that pathway might be, maybe we need to address that more directly. Yeah. It's fascinating. Absolutely. Work. And I really love that. I love the app. I haven't explored it as anywhere near as well as I would like to, but I use it a lot and I recommend it a lot. So it's just helpful. It's a helpful tool.
Yeah. And it goes to show you also, just for a case like me, my mood has been stable for a really long time. And I didn't know what was going on. It was just for a few weeks that I started to realize. I'm like, so I started taking more things that increase serotonin, and
yeah,
it was helping. But I was just like, something's changed a little. I'm not sure what it was. And it just turned out it was chromium.
Chromium. It's one of the first supplements we do. We do our blood sugar balancing program called the Sweet Spot for people. And I have these three core supplements we start people on, right? Because you're not customizing, and then we help them customize. But chromium, magnesium, and DHA. And those make a real big difference in the blood sugar balance. But what does that mean? It means getting the sugars into the cells. I don't really care what your blood sugar is. What I care about is what your cellular level of glucose is, because that's how the mitochondria make energy. You have to get it into the cells. So a lot of people find, this is an interesting fact, a lot of people find that they have hypoglycemia symptoms. And when they start to test their glucose, they find that they actually have those symptoms when their blood sugar's high. And they go, how does that make sense? It makes sense because your sugar's high. And it's not getting into your cells, right? So you don't have the energy, right? You don't have the cellular energy, the brain energy. So it's all those things help when you can measure and when you can give people direction based on that, which is why I'm a big fan. And in our practitioner trainings, we always talk a lot about, you have to understand the biochemistry. You have to understand how it works so that you can help people to optimize that. And hopefully not with 130 supplements a day. No offense, but most of my people don't want to take 130 supplements a day, and neither do I. But we can do it with less. But you're such a self-hacker, right? You're just going in there with these fine minutia things, right? To let me fix this and let me fix that. And that's really cool. Not everybody's going to do that, but with us as practitioners, we have tools that we can use to help us get in and be curious and be the detectives and help people to decode their system. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think for me, I'm really just trying to optimize to any extent that I can. So if I can do another 1%, I don't mind popping another pill. And then
good for you. I'm like, can I get one less pill? I'm not taking any supplements enough, old part.
If it's 200, I'll take 200 supplements if I can get some incremental or marginal benefit. But I don't.
That's great.
That's the question. Is it does get complex when you're at 130?
Yeah, it does.
Because
probably
part of the reason why I was deficient in chromium is because I was also taking zinc, magnesium, and other minerals that were probably also competing with it.
Absolutely.
So I wasn't getting.
We just put together a cool chart that shows all the vitamins and minerals across the top and bottom. And then where they meet is green, yellow, or red, right? Red means they totally interfere with each other. Green means they're good together and they may even have a synergistic effect. And yellow means, just be careful taking them together. So if you're taking that many and you then have to look at, I have to take this sequentially with this, you'd spend your entire day taking supplements. And wouldn't have time for the life that you're trying to optimize, to enjoy the life that you're trying to optimize. It's all about balance.
What goes well with chromium? What does it compete with?
I don't memorize. That's why I create charts.
So what does the chart show?
I don't know. I have to have my chart in front of me.
Oh, you got to bring it up. Okay.
I bring it up. I'm not going to memorize.
No, okay. Of course you're not going to memorize it. That's what you get.
No, that's why I create charts. I'm the queen of charts. And that's what I give in my practitioner training programs. And we have so many charts. I have a lot of genetic charts that show, okay, because I know you don't like to simplify, and we've had that conversation before, but there are some simplification things. And when I can show people, here's your detox pathways, And here's some of the things across the top we're going to check off. Watch out for aflatoxin. Watch out for this. Watch out for that. Increase this, decrease that, and then go test this particular thing. It really helps. So we have 93 pages of charts like that that I just keep creating.
I think all this stuff is very useful to learn, right? Yeah. The more knowledge you have about how the body works, the better.
Absolutely.
Right? It's just, if somebody's a doctor, 90% of what they learn in medical school, they don't put on every patient, but it's still, the more knowledge you have, it's always useful to understand, okay, aflatoxin interacts with what biochemistry, what do I need to know about this?
And then having things you can look up, right? That's what I like about a lot of the reports and self-decode. I can't print off 27 different or 57 or whatever number of reports, summary reports there are for each person. They'll go bonkers and say, forget it, I'm not working with you. But you pick and choose. And then I go back and refer, oh, okay, let's look at this, let's look at that. And it just helps us as practitioners to guide us into the right direction. We can provide good feedback and good response to people.
Absolutely.
People are getting the run of the round. Here's your medication. We don't know what's wrong with you. You must be a psychiatric case. Go see a psychiatrist and get on Prozac. I have loved this conversation. Yes. I love going deep into the weeds but I also like to pull back out to give people that overview. So I'm glad we got to do that.
Awesome.
I appreciate you inviting me.
Where can people find your work?
Absolutely. So for practitioners, inemethod.com is our practitioner site, and it talks all about my philosophy and the functional medicine meets in-depth food chemistry and all this kind of stuff. And then drritamarie.com for those who are looking for health and support for your own health issue. drritamarie.com or inemethod.com.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it. I like geeking out like this.
Awesome. Me too.
Bye.
Bye-bye. 67% of listeners aren't following the show. So please don't forget to show your support by hitting the follow button now. You'll not only be supporting the show, but also investing in yourself and your health journey, all while helping to keep us ad-free.